We're back to the Neil Haley Show on the Total Celebrity segment. I'm excited to welcome the program on Fridays, Coach Karen Hall, WPL Hall of Famer, UNLV running rep, ESPN analyst, and much more. Coach, another awesome guest. We were talking boxing for 2 weeks, but let's go back to football. It's football season, and last night was a shocker for me, seeing the Patriots losing to the Chiefs, but who knows if that was all in design by Belichick. But how are you? And you're ready for the show, aren't you?
I am ready for the show, Neil. You know, I get fired up for Fridays. We have some tremendous, awesome superstars that we get on the line, and today is no different. I'd like to welcome a friend of mine, QB Bryant. Wow, what should I say? Track star, NFL, professional football player, Pittsburgh Steelers. So, QB, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much, Karen and Neil.
Oh, it's an honor.
Good,
thank you.
Good. Well, like Neil said, the NFL season kicked off, and I'm depressed. I'm a Brady fan, so I was shocked, too. So, I don't know. Maybe that was by design. But nonetheless, QB, let's jump in with you and talk about how you went from the track and field to football. So talk about how that happened for you, QB.
Well, I was a three sports guy at Penn Hills, and track was probably my favorite. Only reason is, you know, no one had to throw me the ball, no one had to hand me the ball. You know, it was just runners take your mark, get set, and the game, and it was on you. So, and I realized how important track was to my conditioning to all the other sports. And it's ironic because when I got to college, I went to college on a football scholarship at the University of Minnesota, and they didn't want me to run track. They thought it would take away from my football. And after my sophomore year of spring football, the track coach asked me if I wanted to come out for track, and I did. I trained 3 days and ran in the Big Ten Championship and took third in the 100 and fourth in the 220. So the next spring they let me run track.
Well, that's pretty impressive after 3 days. That's pretty – quite the track note. Now, so when you – say you got a football scholarship from Penn Hill, so were you playing football and track, and then you decided to go the football route?
Oh, yeah. I had scholarships in three sports. I played three sports. And this was 1964, so I didn't get any HBC scholarships because back then most of the schools in the South were segregated, so they had the Walter Paytons and all the Hall of Fame guys from black institutions. They had their run of them, so they really never came up north to recruit. So I was recruited more out of the Big Ten, the Pac-12, Arizona State, and places like that. So then I looked at what I wanted to do. And I was a scorer. I wasn't a shooter. I wasn't a Steph Curry. But, on any given day, if I got hot, I could hurt you. But I was tough on defense and assist. I like passing the ball to my guys. And back then, they didn't even count assists. So I didn't see a career in basketball. And track at that time, there was no professional track. And I wanted to be, since I was a kid watching football on TV, I wanted to be a professional football player. So I chose Minnesota because at that time, Minnesota was more progressive. They had a guy named Sandy Stevens from Uniontown, Pennsylvania, who was one of the first black quarterbacks at a major institution. And he took Minnesota to a national championship and a Rose Bowl victory. So, the Rose Bowl was the bowl back then. you didn't have all these different bowls. There were only about four. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had aspirations of following him. And actually, he went on my trip up to Minnesota. He was my sponsor, so he showed me around. So I was stoked to go to Minnesota.
You saw Minnesota as a place that could be not just a home for football, but a home for you going to college. You felt comfortable there, didn't you?
Oh yeah, because you know, I mean, that, you know, that was that was the era of segregation and Jim Crow, and you know, Minnesota embraced you know, athletes of color, and you know, as a matter of fact, I played with. There were three black quarterbacks on my team when I played there. And as we're being honored, we won the 1967 Big Ten Championship. And we're being honored the end of the month on the 29th for the 50th year reunion and celebration. Mm-hmm. They haven't won one since. So
Nice.
So I'll be going up there for that. But, yeah, it was it was more liberal. I think they cared about you too a little bit more than just being an athlete. A lot of the guys were graduating, and that was very important to my mother. She had the final say. She wanted me to go to Grove City. She wanted me to be close, but she had the final say. And Coach Bosses, who was an assistant head coach, he convinced her that. I would get an education as well as they would look out for me. So that was the final say.
In the student-athlete portion of it, it seemed like at that point in time, getting an education is very important when you're talking about what was happening in that time period. Right, Hubie? That time period, it's like, you know, if I'm getting this huge opportunity, I'm going to make the best of it in class, in school, as your mom wanted you to.
Well, you know, my mother was I'm not a – I'll be very truthful. I'll take you on this journey. I wasn't very – I was a smart kid. I just didn't like the classroom. And it wasn't that I didn't have a value for education. It was just so boring for me and so slow. I'm kind of like an action person. You know, that's why I don't golf, because it takes forever. I'll never forget during basketball season one year, I got a couple C's on my report card, and my mother said, "Well, you know you're not playing any basketball till these C's come off of here." And I said, "Okay." So I told my basketball coach, and he said, "Hey man, you're eligible." I said, "Hey man, you know." So he said, "Hey, I'm going to talk to your mom." I was shaking my head. I said, "Well, if you want to do that, that's on you." So he came to the house, knocked on the door, and said, "Miss Bryant, I'm so-and-so basketball coach." And I was confused because, you know, you took your son off of the basketball team because he had a couple seasons. He's still eligible. And she said, "Look, coach, no disrespect, but I'm not raising no average kid." She understood that as a black man that you couldn't be average. You had to be above average to even get – you know, an opportunity. So with that in mind, I made good grades. I was never on probation, but there was something that happened to a lot of students at Minnesota. They had something called General College. Being the first in my family to go to, I had no idea. There was no path for me to follow, so I was kind of like the trailblazer. And I found out at the end of my sophomore year that General College was like a junior college within the university. And the University of Minnesota, there were 44,000 students. So, I mean, I was lost. And some of our classes, they didn't have cable back then, but they were on closed circuit TV. I'll never forget my psych class. I think there was like 1,500 people in north of auditorium, you know, so it was very, very, very sterile. And just finding your advisor was like a task. So it wasn't that personal. So I didn't have a lot of personal contact. I just took the courses that my advisor said, and you know, I did well in the courses. But by me being in general college, they told me that it was time for me to graduate. And I said, wait a minute, I just got here. I'm a sophomore. And they said, well, you can transfer into the university. I said, I thought I was in the university. So that little mishap right there put me about a year and a quarter behind graduation. So needless to say, you know, I transferred in. I'd like to say now, too, that there weren't a lot of choices that I really liked. Like today, you know, you have the option. I would have been a great sports management major. I'd have been able to, you know, to major in
Hello? Coach, you there?
Hello. I'm here. Hubie?
Okay. Hubie, we like lost him for a second, so we'll continue with Coach Hall and we'll wait for Hubie to give us a call back. Now, Coach, interesting when you talk about the opportunities that he went ahead and decided to go after. I mean, a college education, take us back, you know, history-wise, Coach, that was a time where not a lot of African Americans went to college, right? And to get that opportunity, what a great way he was able to take that in football and to use it for his advantage to be successful.
Oh, so true, Neil. It's so interesting to hear him leave a Pittsburgh, PA at that time in our history and go to Minnesota, and then for him to say that a Minnesota was more progressive in terms of race relations than his hometown, and then have the opportunity to feel welcomed in, you know, in the Midwest, basically, at the University of Minnesota, which, you know, probably had, as you said, he had a handful of black quarterbacks he played with, but overall, I still wouldn't think they were a very low percentage of African-American students. But to feel welcome is courageous on his part to go to a school like University of Minnesota at that time. It was interesting, though, Neil, when Hubie talked about he was at the University of Minnesota, but academically, he was sort of like in the junior college, and he only found out when they said, okay, it's time for you to graduate. Now, that was such an interesting part because being such a large university, as he mentioned, he had difficulty, you know, getting to an academic advisor, someone to guide him and lead him. So many challenges he was facing there, and still to be able to get himself matriculated through as a graduate of the University of Minnesota, the true testament to, and I'm sure his mom sound like had a huge influence on his life overall. And so I'm sure that gave him a lot of will too.
Definitely. And we right now he is off the line. So I guess our producers will have to try to grab him. But talking about what's happened, Coach, with him as a quarterback. So you said he was a quarterback at the University of Minnesota then. Is that correct, or cornerback?
Wide receiver, I believe.
Wide receiver, okay. And then after University of Minnesota, then he went on to the Steelers, right?
Yeah, he went on to he didn't get drafted. He ends up getting a tryout. I think he was in with on like the CBL league. And I think he was headed up to Toronto to sign a contract. And then a coach there, you know, was able to work him into a tryout with the Pittsburgh Steelers. And the story goes, Neil, it was just funny, that when he got his letter to attend tryout in camp, they didn't really have a locker for him. So you know what that meant. They figured a 5'10 guy at about 160 in the NFL, he's not going to make it. So they didn't even have his name on the list, and then his locker was like a makeshift. They had like a chair, and like his helmet was hanging up on a nail on the wall. So I thought, wow, you know, what motivation would that give anyone to then go out and prove himself? And he actually ended up making the team. you know, I'm sure it's everyone's surprise. So that's how he ended up getting from Minnesota through, like, the now what we call, like, CFL, the Arena League. Like, he was playing that type of football. And then found himself in Pittsburgh Steeler camp.
And what years was he in Pittsburgh Steeler camp, Coach Hall?
Yeah, he was 71. I know he played 3 years of NFL, so 71, 72, and then or 73, 72, and then I think he finished up with New. Well, I know he finished up with the New England Patriots. How about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he had talked about in a conversation we had that, you know, he was injury free for the most part of his career until he had trouble with AstroTurf. You know,
we
just
do have
running
him back in the line. Coach.
Oh, good.
I think we have him back in the line. Hubie, are you back in the line?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Not a problem. Let's just jump right to – we did a little bit of history with you in Minnesota. Coach Hall is a great way to kind of bring us back. I'm going to go right into you. After your career with University of Minnesota, you had a difficult path to the NFL that you had to overcome a lot of obstacles. Tell us those obstacles to get the opportunity to play for the Pittsburgh Steelers and the New England Patriots.
Okay, well – my size was always against me. You know, being 5'10", 155 pounds, I was always the smallest guy on every team from grade school on. And, you know, it was supposedly back in those days a big man's game. And but the one element that – there's two things about football that people cherish, size and speed. And I had close to Olympic type speed. I was a Big Ten sprint champion indoors in the 60 and outdoors in the 2:22 and 100. And so that speed always gave me an option. Plus I was a tough little guy. They used to bring me in on goal line situations if I wasn't in the game. And I would be the lead blocker for Jimbo Carter. Big Jimbo played for Green Bay Packers, and he was about 225, and I would lead block for him, and you would think it would be the other way around. But so I took great pride in my blocking, and a lot of times it was a way for me to release a little bit of hostility, the fact that they wouldn't throw me the ball, so I would go down and smack a linebacker or DB and knock him on your keister. So it was tough, and I was fortunate that I ran into a guy at – well, let me tell you my journey. I was cut by the Cleveland Browns after being the top rookie the rookie camp week, and then – Blanton Collier, the head coach, gave me a number for the Wheeling Ironman and told me to go down there, try to get some seasoning, and who knows, maybe, you know, if they have a need, they could bring me back, or maybe next year they could give me an opportunity, but at least I could get some experience. So I played 2 years with the Wheeling Ironman, and my head coach got a job. The league folded. And my head coach got a job with Blesto, who back then was the exclusive scouting combine for the Steelers. And he recommended me, and the Steelers signed me to a free agent contract of $12,000. So I was able to come to camp. And I met Lionel Taylor, who to this day he and Chuck are responsible for me making it. Lionel had the faith in me. He didn't care anything about my size. He just wanted me to go out there and, like he would say every day, give me something that I can go into these meetings and fight for you for. And fortunately, I returned punts also. And the last exhibition game was the first game played in Three River Stadium against the New York Giants. And I had a punt return for about 60 or 70 yards that night, caught a couple balls, and made the team. So That's how it went.
That sounds like a little trivia question regarding the opening of the Three River Stadium there in UV.
Yeah, I have the game ball from the first game played in Three River Stadium. I was awarded right after the game. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what do you think the change of the whole mindset of the Steelers once you got to Three Rivers compared to playing at Pitt Stadium?
Oh well, you know, I don't think those guys, none of those guys were around. I mean, for me, that was great. I used to be one of the kids that used to throw the mattress over the barbed wire and sneak in. But I don't think there was any residual feelings one way or another, because most of those guys never heard of Pitt Stadium anyway, so they had no idea. That was Chuck's second year, so you know he was already putting the pieces together to rebuild and make the Steelers the team that they are today. So there was no residual feelings about Pitt Stadium. It was like Pitt who, you know.
And that's a great point, Hubie. That basically when Coach Knoll came, he cleaned house. He changed that team completely. Explain that to our
listeners. Yeah, he changed the whole atmosphere and the whole culture.
So he's a laid back guy, but he was a smart man, and you had a chance to watch that.
Chuck wasn't a real personable guy, but he wasn't a mean guy. You know, Chuck's situation was this. Look, you're here to play ball. I don't want any nonsense, all right? Long as you played ball, you never heard from Chuck. And it was funny because I don't know if you guys remember. I look at guys like Cam Newton and, you know, some of these guys that are fashioneers in today's game. And you know, everybody wants to know what Cam's going to wear, what LeBron is going to wear. And I don't know if you guys remember Frenchie Fuqua.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The goldfish in the shoes. And, you know, and Chuck didn't care about all that. He didn't care what you wore. He said, whatever you wear, he said, the more flamboyant you are, the more flamboyant you better be on that field making plays.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a issue of him. And I look at these guys now, and I think about, man, they couldn't compete with the Frenchman, man. When he broke out with those goldfish in his shoes, the count and his cape and his cane, that was it.
So Hubie,
I
was going to say, Hubie, as we're getting close to winding down. You were with the Steelers to what year? Tell us.
I was just there 70, and then I was the last cut. They tried to sneak me through. There was another player that had a little bit more notoriety than I did. They tried to sneak me through waivers and New England claimed me because, you know, the last cut, you have to clear waivers in order to re-sign, and I didn't clear. New England grabbed me, so I end up at Gillette Stadium. I opened up two brand new stadiums, Three Rivers and Gillette Stadium, and I played with two Hall of Fame quarterbacks because Jim Plunkett was their number one draft choice.
Wow.
So, Hubie, with all the football experience, you have administration experience. How do you utilize that to mentor kids today that say, hey, you know, I'm pretty good at football? So what do you tell them? Like what's some real world advice that you try to implant into some of these kids?
I give these guys my experience because one thing happened to me when I finished playing professional football. You know, that got me in a few corporation doors, and when they asked me, you know, about my degree, and I said, well, I only have associates, the conversation changed. So by Coach Bailey giving me the opportunity not only to coach, but also to finish my education, okay, I tell them that story. You know, I said, no matter, you know, what level you were on, whether you were all pro or just a guy that played, I said, if you don't have a degree, you don't have anything to fall back on, because then you have to start your life off and you're searching for what you're going to do. And I said, and today, in today's education, back then, I'll never forget, English was the toughest class at Minnesota. And I was struggling with it. And somebody suggested that I could take communications as a substitute for English. And my communication teacher told me, man, you would be a great sports analyst. But at that time, there were no black sports analysts on TV or radio. So I didn't see that as an option. Today, the options are wide open. You can be anything that you want to be. Like I say, I would have been in sports management, and I would have been a commissioner because, to be truthful, I spent 40-plus years coaching, 21 of them in HBCU colleges, and I also ran the study halls. So I set up the study hall, and I said, hey, man, you know, there are no dumb athletes. If you can understand the playbook, you can understand your course book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we had very strict rules about, you know, eligibility. And I'll be able to say that we had over our time in coaching, we had a 77% graduation rate. So education, I told them I did it the wrong way. I said I tried it, it didn't work. I'm trying to save you. And most of my kids, they'll hit me up on Facebook and they'll thank me and the rest of the coaching staff for, you know, pushing them not only on the field, but, you know, they're doing great. There's so many kids that have great careers and great families, and that's the real thank you that means a lot to me.
Yes.
All right. Well, fantastic. QB, is there a place people can kind of look you up? Is it more like Wikipedia, Google you, to find information on you, what you're doing now, and what's going on with you?
Oh, yeah. I'm all over Google. people now, I'm kind of semi-retired. I coached, like I say, at HBCUs for 21 years, and mm-hmm. I came home two years ago, and I volunteered out at Valley High School with my good friend Muzzy Calissimo last year. But let me say this too in closing. Parents need to calm down because, you know, all your kids are not stars. All your kids are not going to become professional football players. They need to come to practice and observe some of these kids, and then they'll realize, you know, it's a merit-based situation. You know, if they're good enough, they're going to play. If they're good enough, they're going to rise. But if they're not, just because they were great in midget football doesn't mean that they're going to be great at the next level.
All right,
they're
well
ruining,
said.
They're ruining great, sports.
Great point. Well, Hubie, thanks for calling. Great show, guys. Take care, and best of luck to you, Hubie. And, Coach, we'll talk next week.
Okay,
hey, look,
I'd like to say
a prayer for the people in Houston,
yes,
the Caribbean, and Florida.
All right. All right. Thanks, Hubie. Thanks, Coach. Take care,
okay,
guys.
Yep.
All right.
Bye. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. That was the Neil Haley Show. Take care, everyone. We're back to the Neil Haley Show. And this segment, again, I am interested in this segment. It's a learning segment in so many ways. So I'm excited to welcome to the program Bill Rivati. He writes for the V4 and Bill, thanks for calling. And a lot of people probably don't know a lot about the V4, but Bill, tell us your background, especially what you do and how, and then we'll figure out how you got involved in this whole V4 thing.
Well, the Visegrad Four Nations are made up of four countries in Central Europe. And number one, they're Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, and Slovakia. And these four countries are relatively new to the European Union, and they formed to promote their interest within the Union. But where they really became prominent was back in 2015 when Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, declared her open border policy in Europe, and the migration wave hit, and you know, those four countries resisted, and it's been an ongoing battle between the so-called powers of Western Europe, they call themselves EU core, and the new Visegrad Four, who is defying their agenda. So it's an ongoing battle, and we formed to promote the interests of the V4, especially not only here but in Europe, because of the way the media portrays the situation. We feel is not fair or accurate, especially here in Western, in the United States.
And that's interesting you talk about that, Bill, because a lot of people don't understand. They think of all of the European Union having the same ideals, the same mindset, especially when first the European Union was formed, it was going to be even bigger than the United States, right? Better economy, more unified. And that was the ultimate goal. But as you saw with, you talked about the V4 versus the other countries in the EU, that they just, the mindset was completely different when that was formed historically, right?
Correct. And the European Union, you know, as far as an economic union, that was the idea. Okay, let's bring these countries together. We can kind of have a free trade within Europe. Let's compete with the world from here. But like anything else, once people get power, they tend to want to acquire more and more power. And the European Union has really morphed into a monstrosity where they're now trying to dictate to the nation states, you know, what their migration policy will be, what their, you know, gun control, for instance, that they want to, you know, to limit the guns of the Czech Republic and Hungary, so it's really taken on a new power where, you know, in a lot of cases they want to override the powers and meddle in what is should be policies of the nation states, including migration. And that was one of the big issues, is they wanted to force the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia to take in a certain amount of migrant quotas. And they resisted, and now the battle is going to court, and they're going to, you know, attempt to sanction them. So it's ongoing as we speak.
And that was not the ultimate goal of the EU at all. And that's something that frustrates you, Bill, right? It was a financial thing, not a political thing.
Well, in the treaty, you know, in national security issues are clearly delegated to the nation states. The European Union, you know, should not be permitted to come in and you know, to affect the security policies of the nation states. And with these quotas where they're forcing them to take migrants, in which they consider a national security risk and have good reason to think that, because a lot of the not only some of the terror attacks that have been committed over there, but a lot of the attacks you don't hear about, from sexual assaults to, you know, just regular assault, are being committed by the migrants. In a lot of cases, the courts, these European courts, make it almost impossible to deport the illegal migrants. And that's another problem as well.
That definitely seems like a definite problem. But why the V4 bill? Now that goes back to the background of why these four countries are important to you, why you are a spokesperson in Europe and for the V4, not just in the United States, but all over the world, to try to get this message out.
Well, it was interesting. A lot of people were asking me that, but my wife was born and raised in the Czech Republic. So she is Czech, and when we got married 16 years ago, we spent our honeymoon there, and now we're there twice a year. In fact, we spend the entire summers there. I have three daughters under 10 years old. So it's important for me to keep that country safe, because it's very safe. In fact, all the V4 countries are very safe and not experiencing the same type of ongoing terror or other type of attacks you see in Western Europe. So we do have interest there, property interest. And, you know, when I came back in the summer of 2015, when this crisis, migrant crisis first started happening in the early stages, and I heard how it was being reported here in the United States. In fact, it was KDKA Radio, the morning show, CBS. I was appalled. They were portraying this as something about women and children coming from, you know, poor refugees fleeing war. And there were some of those cases, but the majority, the far majority have been young, aggressive males coming to Europe, and they're economic migrants, not refugees fleeing war. So again, we try to distinguish between, we want to help the refugees fleeing war, but at the same time, you have to secure your borders to know who's coming over. And you just can't allow every economic migrant who wants to come here, you know, for the rich benefits of Germany or Sweden, you know, to come. You have to secure your borders, because along those borders come dangerous risks. You know, some Islamic terrorists from the Middle East slip by with the refugees. So the V4 always has our positions, in which we outline on our website pages on how we best think it's the best way to help the true war refugees, which in our case is not relocation to Europe, but is to helping them in local, working with local charities to help support them in safe camps, with the ultimate goal to return home once these wars are over. But clearly right now,
I apologize. I was going to look at, when you talk about that bill, and that's very, very interesting, the process, the safety, that's gigantic. That you're seeing on the news, that you talk about migration and different flooding into different countries and how the V4 is not allowing that, and how they're safer countries. Describe some of the things that are different in the four countries, especially the Czech Republic compared to the UK, Spain, or, you know, any of the other European countries. What do you see as differences? Because I'm sure you've traveled to other countries, not just the Czech Republic.
Well, I have now. I can't say that I've been to Spain or Greece, but, you know, I've been to numerous, you know, from Germany to Croatia to Rome, Czech Republic, Slovakia, and one example, and I don't know if I'm hitting on exactly what you're trying to say, I'll get to that later, is the fallacy and the danger. This is in Greece is when a lot of the migrants first started coming through Turkey. And our problem with Greece, the leaders of Greece, is they let everybody in. You know, most of these people didn't even have ID, so you don't know who's coming over. And then instead of keeping them in Greece, they waved them through to others. So you had all a storm of these unknown migrants with no identification storming up north because they all wanted to get to Germany and Sweden. And obviously someone was training these people, open border activists, and telling them, you know, where to go. So there was a lot of internal smugglers involved too. And, you know, they knew to go, you know, they all wanted to head to Germany because Germany pays the biggest welfare benefits in Sweden. But out of that, the danger to this is, you know, one spent a year in jail for attempted murder, a migrant in Greece, and they gave him amnesty after 1 year. He lied about his age to get in and said he was 16, and he wasn't 16, he was an adult. And he ends up committing a rape and then murdering a German teen girl about a year ago. So, you know, there's a lot of mayhem that goes on along with this. And to just open your border to anybody exposes your citizens. And I think it's highly negligent, irresponsible, and abnormal, if you ask me. And this is the philosophy of these leaders in Brussels, you know, embracing this type of cultural Marxism you see. And that's definitely not in line with the culture of Central Europe, you know, made up of Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, and Czech. And a lot of these countries have a Catholic background. Now, the Czech Republic is atheist. Their culture is, they celebrate all the, you know, their culture is Christian. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you know, they believe in these traditions, although they tend not to be believers themselves. But Poland and Slovakia and Hungary are very solid in their faith. So, but the cultural differences, too, what you see in Britain, France, Belgium, is a huge problem going on, and even Germany now, with the integration of Muslims. And, you know, you're not supposed to talk about this situation, but it's a problem. And the facts are there in the countries that have large populations with Muslims in the minority. They're having huge problems with integration. There's cultural clashes, you know, terror attacks in those countries. And, you know, there's major issues with, are they going to accept the European culture, or will they try to force their culture on others there? And that's been a major problem. In the Czech Republic, Poland, Slovakia, and Hungary, you don't have really don't have the Muslim populations. And, you know, pretty much everybody adheres to the same culture, although it is different. So.
Absolutely. Well, Bill, we're going to have a monthly segment. You're also going to be the places to kind of really learn about the day-to-day situations that are happening in other countries in Europe and the concerns of the V4. The best place to find information on you is to follow you on Twitter. Tell us where on Twitter and like your Facebook page and website. So tell us those places to find you.
Yeah, definitely our highest activity. We're on three places, but our highest activity is on our Facebook page. You know, we post daily there. It's called the V4 Report. V4, the number 4, and then report. And that's where our followers engage. You know, they're mostly from Central Europe, and you'll find out daily activities plus some long-term strategies from that site. Twitter, the same V4 report on Twitter, is more of our short, you know, daily short hits on subjects. And we tend to be a little bit more aggressive there and even use some humor. And then we have our site, the V4 report, that posts all our articles. Those are more long-term strategies, you know, and philosophies.
Well, Bill, I was just thinking about this. A lot of times we're getting a message in the media that's not the message you're giving. And you're not, and it needs to be said. And you have the proof by following those three areas and engaging. So people in the United States, we do have our show on in the UK as well, and all over the world, but we definitely are on in London. They really need to kind of look at this and say, wow, here's the proof. It's not a bunch of, you know, editorials. You find articles. You find information that is true, that has happened, to let people know about what's going on. And we appreciate it. We look forward to having you as a monthly guest on the show. So thanks again for calling, Bill, and we'll be in touch, okay?
Thanks for having me, Neil.
All right, take care. Okay, bye-bye. You listen to the Neil Haley Show, and we'll be back in just a moment.